This is the Financial Sense News Hour. With the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
And a hearty welcome back to our Lifetime Income series, an ongoing series as a subset of The Big Picture every week here on the program. When we started the series, we established the concept that laying the foundation for a retirement is, first of all, you need a plan. And a plan begins with a budget. And the budget needs to have two parts. The essential part of the budget, what you really are going to have as income, and what you really need to lay out in terms of expenses, the things you have to have and have to pay for. And the second would be what you call the surplus section, or in colloquial expressions, the bucket list. What do you want to do before you kick the bucket? So the key to a secure plan, the key to a secure retirement is having a plan, because you're more likely to be successful than shooting from the hip, where you're always on edge and wondering if you've been doing everything you're supposed to be doing. I don't know if you ever heard of the executive monkey study, Jim, where they took two primates and put them in these little zapper chairs that could give them a shock. And they both had buttons, and one monkey had a button that didn't do anything. He could click it all at once, and the other monkey actually turned off the shock. And so they'd shock the monkeys, and the monkey with a placebo button found very soon that it didn't do anything. And the monkey with the button that you could push found out that it did something. And the monkey who could do something developed an ulcer, because he was always sitting on edge waiting for the next zap that he knew he'd had to turn off. And he was always anxious because of that. Whereas the monkey that couldn't do anything about it, didn't worry about it. And that's the same deal about doing a plan here. We're entitling this part of Lifetime Income, What Am I Afraid Of? Dealing with monsters in your closets, fears, and retiring with security. Anyway, pick up the theme from there.
Not sure where I was going to go from with the monkey story. Not sure I could back that one up. But, you know, you mentioned something that you start with a plan, and the key ingredient for that is having a budget. But, John, there's another element here. And that is specificity, because a lot of retirees or even individuals that are planning for retirement are saying, you know, their goals are what I call generalities. Well, I'd like to retire between the ages 62 and 63. You know, I'd like to do a little bit more travel. I might want to live near the kids, maybe have a second vacation home. And they really don't focus on, gee, if I do retire, what will it cost me? What are going to be my living expenses, as you talked about, the basic essential needs and the bucket list? And then also, what are going to be my source of revenues? And how am I going to plan for that? And it's really, I mean, every business, every major successful corporation starts out at the end of the year, they come up with a budget for the following year. They know what their expenses are. They know if they're going to increase spending on either hiring more personnel, buy more equipment, capital expenditures. They have goals that they set out. You know, we want to achieve this penetration of our market. We want to come out with this new product. Every successful business does that. I'm always amazed how very few people, when it comes to retirement, do not do that when it comes to their own financial well-being.
Well, when you have clients come to you and they say, we want to do a retirement plan, you have to say, you sit down and do a budget. And they look at you and say, thank you, but you're not the gentleman for the job. We didn't want to have to work at this. Do you encounter that a lot, or how difficult is that to do?
It is a little bit of difficulty. I once had, and I'm not going to say who this person was, but it was, let's call it a celebrity couple. And this goes back into the mid-80s, and they were getting themselves into financial trouble. And so I sat down with them, and we said, look, we need to come up with a plan. You are, number one, spending more than you're taking in terms of revenue, and celebrity income can be quite generous in a year, or it could be less generous depending on what pictures they're making. And I said, you got to have a budget here. You're spending way too much money. I need you to focus. They had bought, they were living in a very, very expensive home, and they didn't want to be inconvenienced by selling that home because they were building a new, more expensive home, an even bigger one, more lavish, more expensive. So they were financing two homes, a large yacht, let's call it a fractional ownership in a jet. And so I said, we got to come up with a budget. You got to live within your means, folks. Not to mention the fact that the kids, they owned horses as well, in which the kids were taking riding lessons. And so we had a yacht, we had a jet, we had horses, and we had two homes, and things weren't going well. And all of a sudden, over a series of meetings, I became the bad guy. The reason they couldn't satisfy their financial needs was Jim's got us on a budget. And I can remember one meeting they came in, and this particular star was saying, all right, tell them what you did. And she went out and bought a brand new car. And so I'm saying, well, you haven't got rid of your last one. How's this working? And John, I became the bad guy. And so, I mean, that's exactly what they did. They eventually left me, fired me, and went someplace else. Sorry to say, filed bankruptcy. And so this is why it's generally a difficult thing to do if you're not used to having maybe some constraints. And let's face it, some people are going to retire. They may not have the same revenues that they had when they were working or they were active in their careers, or depending on how well that they planned for it. But it's generally easy to do a budget, and especially for retirement planning, because, John, we have forms and questionnaires that help the client to organize their thoughts and zero in on the priorities and get specific, because that's what you have to do. You have to have a budget. You have to get specific. Is this essential or is this in the bucket list category? And then getting people to sort of sort that out. But that is generally probably easier to do, because if they're coming to you for a retirement plan or some kind of plan to put their affairs in order, they got to give you information. And, you know, one of the things that we're going to require is doing a budget, prioritizing your goals, sequencing those goals, like, okay, I've got all these things you want to do. What's number one? What's number two? What's number three? Let's prioritize those.
Well, okay, so that's where they are reluctant to do a budget, or if you get them on a budget, they don't want to stay on it for obvious reasons because it involves discipline. What about people who want to do something, but then they don't want to put all their cards on the table so you can tell them which hand to play? They don't want to divulge their information.
That has surfaced. I mean, if that comes up, we basically turn them away. You know, I try to use the analogy with them as a doctor or a physician. Let's say that you move to a new area. You need to get a local doctor as your primary care physician. You walk into the doctor's office. He's probably going to want to ask you your health history, about your family, you know, longevity issues. Do you have any issues of cancer, heart disease in the family? And then he's probably going to want to give you a physical, which means he's going to have to, you know, he's probably going to want to have your blood tested. There may be x-rays. Can you imagine going into a doctor and you're not feeling well and you go, well, you know, I don't want to talk about my family. No, don't want to talk about that. I don't like blood tests because when they stick a needle in the arm, it hurts. It doesn't go well. I can remember, Johnny, you can probably relate to this. As you get older, there are more tests that you do when you age. For example, in a male, they start taking PSA tests for prostate cancer when you're in your 40s, and they follow that. As you get in your 50s, they start doing things like colonoscopies. And as you get older, there are various more tests that doctors want to do to monitor your health to see that everything is working internally. I remember the first time I had to get, it's not a colonoscopy. What's the one where they do the lower GI tract? They don't put you under for it. I forget what.
Sigmoidoscopy.
Yeah. And I remember when I turned 50, my doctor wanted me to have one. And a friend of mine was playing on my fears. And, he had me scared out of my wits. So I went in to go for my test. And the nurse takes me into this room. And ladies, I sympathize with you out there with dealing with a gynecologist, because they leave me in this room, John, to myself and my imagination. And I'm looking at all these examining chairs they have for women. And, you know, I thought I was in a medieval torture chamber. And so the doctor came in, he looked at me. I must have had sweat coming down my forehead. And I go, I'm really not looking forward to this. I've heard this, this, this. And he just started giggling and said, who have you been talking to? And I said, well, my buddy. And he said, well, no, they're kind of pulling your leg. But you have to provide, you know, whether you're going to a doctor or you're going to a financial planner, you have to give them that information, because how can you put together a plan without information? You don't know your tax bracket. You don't know your income sources. You don't know your assets and expenses. It's simply impossible. And believe it or not, I've been in situations like the one in the 80s where I've turned the people away.
Okay, well, let's suppose that handcuffing your client to the desk worked and you did get a budget out of them. Okay. You're going to take off the handcuffs now. What comes next?
You know, and this is actually, quite honestly, the more difficult step in the process. And this is the hardest part, and that is dealing with emotional fears. In other words, the question that we really try to address is, what are you afraid of? And you know, John, when you get into emotional fears, there's a lot of stigma, there's a lot of things that you have to deal with psychologically that are sometimes very difficult. I talked about the case of Bill and Jan, where here's a gentleman that rolled over his IRA back in 2006, got it invested, and wham, here comes the 2007-2009 bear market. So we had to deal with the issues of Bill being afraid of being in the stock market. He got out of the stock market in 2009, was strictly in cash, and that was a real major issue in that plan. And so dealing with these emotional fears, I think, is it's probably the more difficult part of the process.
Chris, you know, in the last segment of the program, we were talking about uncertainty as having a real damping effect on the business environment, because small business owners, all business owners at this stage, still aren't really sure what's going to happen. And as a result, they're left with uncertainty. They don't know what to do. Anything could be changing. There's nothing stable right now. But, you know, if you're planning for retirement, you could say pretty much the same thing. Because, all right, let's see, are they going to means test Social Security? Maybe they're going to tax Social Security. What happens if they stop paying it or begin reneging and moving things down, raising the bar higher? What about inflation? You don't know what these guys in Washington are doing from year to year, and it's got everybody on edge. You can't plan. It's not a stable environment. So how do you build that in?
Well, we have a section that we go through, and we call it, what are you afraid of? Once we have the essential budget and the bucket list, because you have to deal with that. If you don't deal with it, you really aren't going to put together an effective plan, because a lot of times there can be emotional stigmas. As I mentioned in one of the first cases we discussed between Bill and Jan, and the losses that Bill took on the rollover of his 401k program. So, but I would say if we were to classify them, I would say they fall into five categories. At the top of the list is the fear that inflation will be higher, because let's face it, all of us over the last decade have seen our gasoline costs go up, our food costs go up, our cable bills, our insurance premiums, all the day-to-day living expenses, which is why we try to focus, when we put together a budget, the essential cost of living. So I would say at the top of the list is that inflation may be higher, especially when, you know, they hear talk about QE1, QE2, Operation Twist. Everybody's printing money. And of course, you know, you don't have to be a genius. I mean, every housewife is probably a better economist than most economists that we talk to, because they go into the store, they pay the bills. And so they see this on a real-time basis every day of the week. So at the top of the list is inflation. A second one is the fear that they're going to outlive their assets. Do I have enough in my investment portfolio to live on, or am I going to be faced with a situation where I'm dipping into my principal? And what happens with longevity running in our family? I outlive my assets. So outliving assets is probably number two. And probably number three, John, you hit on it. Will my Social Security benefits be cut? I mean, you know, the president demagogued the Social Security issue during the debt ceiling debate. We've seen the government break its promises. Social Security was supposed to be tax-free. Then they start taxing 50% of it. And then under Clinton, we raised the tax to tax up to 85% of it, depending on your income. There's also now they're starting to require, based on your income, you could see your Medicare taxes or your Medicare premiums double and based on your income. And so, you know, a lot of people are seeing this. And so I think Social Security, which is a segment of one, you know, it's one of the few what I call defined benefit type pension plans that people have counted on. And so there's concerns about that. The other thing, I would say number four, is will investment returns be less than expected? I mean, let's face it. I'm looking at a treasury screen here where a one-year treasury bill is less than 0.2%. It's 16 basis points. A two-year treasury note is less than 0.25%. A seven-year treasury note is 1%. And we've seen two bear markets in the last decade. So I would say number four is will returns be less than expected? And probably the fifth one I'd probably throw out there, what happens to healthcare costs? We know the government is going to probably go to some kind of healthcare rationing. We know that they're asking now with people that have a certain level of income as a result of Obamacare are going to have to pay higher Medicare premiums. What if they take that away? What if I have to pay more? Or even worse, what if I'm saddled with an unexpected healthcare expense? What if one spouse becomes incapacitated, dementia, Alzheimer's, or a severe disability? So I would say in that section, those are the five common fears that we usually have to address. And we call this section, What Am I Afraid Of?
You know, this all, what we're talking about here, dovetails in with the first part of the big picture today, because the president right now is just repeating this taxation mantra over and over and over again. We know that we've got this fiscal cliff. That term, by the way, fiscal cliff, is, if you notice, is entering the mainstream jargon right now, whereas at one time only people like us were talking about it. And so you have a serious tax-mageddon situation, serious situation coming up. So what are your clients doing in terms of this? Because this is one of these variables. You don't know where this is going to wind up.
Well, I mean, we have quite a few wealthy clients. About half of our clients are in the, what I would call the one percenter. And by the way, being in the 1% doesn't mean that you're fabulously rich. I mean, we're defining that 1% if you make 200,000 or 250, or you have a certain amount of assets. But we've got plans where we're focusing to minimize those income taxes. We're doing a lot of shifting into muni bonds. The other thing that we've got in place, we've already done it, and we may even have to implement either further plans, is sheltering estate taxes, because, you know, everybody's talking about income taxes, but they forget right now the exemption on estates is $5 million. So a husband and wife with a living trust can pass $10 million onto their heirs without any estate taxes. If you're fortunate enough to have assets above $10 million, the tax rate is 35%. That all changes come January 1st. The exemption drops by 80% from $5 million down to $1 million, which is basically a homeowner in California. And the estate tax, the death tax, goes up from 35% to 55%. So we've got, especially with our wealthiest clients, I mean, we've got various tools that we're discussing, whether it's a charitable remainder trust. In one instance, we're creating a foundation because we manage a lot of foundation money, and then special trust, especially a tax replacement trust or generation skipping trust, depending on how large the estate is. But I mean, John, there are a lot of tools to work with. And I mean, I mentioned in last week when we concluded the Steins case, right now he would only have income taxes on his pension and IRA assets when both Matt and Deborah pass on. But if the estate tax rates change in, let's say, January of next year, then we'll probably be setting up a tax replacement trust to cover the additional taxes. And we will start an aggressive gifting program to his two daughters and his son. In other cases where we have individuals that have subchapter S corporations, we'll be probably setting up C corps at the end of the year. So, you know, depending on the outcome of elections, I could be working 6 day weeks come November, depending on what's going to happen in the November elections in January 1st.
So it's something that I've always said. The rich are never soaked. They take whatever, and they have the means usually, to take whatever evasive action they can. Sometimes they're in bed with the congresspeople making these laws, and there are little loopholes left in there. But as a rule, governments never get more than about 20% of their GDP. It seems to be one of those fixed laws of the universe, but politicians don't seem to learn that.
No, and one of the reasons it's never been more than 20% of GDP, number one, raising taxes kills the economy, which means less tax revenues, deficits go up, and number two, as we just talked about, the wealthy aren't going to sit there and take it. I mean, you know, Warren Buffett talks about the Buffett tax, but let me tell you, you read his biography, he's one of the biggest crony capitalists around. Buffett has done more, and in fact, he talks about it, he's quite proud of it, to minimize his taxes. Berkshire Hathaway is Warren Buffett's own personal tax shelter, and it's one of the reasons he's become one of the richest men in the world, and he's done that through tax planning. So you're right, John. The wealthy have the means and the wherewithal, and plus they have access to knowledgeable advisors that are going to help minimize the taxes. They're not going to sit there and say, okay, I'll pay the tax.
So, you know, if we listen to what you and Rob have been saying about shifting into munis, and if people such as your clients have a plan, we gave an example of a fictitious, well, a real fictitious group, a family known as the Steins, real people, just the names have been changed. Are your clients telling you right now that given what they perceive, it really is time to go to plan B?
Oh, absolutely. I'm working with two of my clients that have companies, one of them with well over, I think they're over 100 employees. One client is looking at Nevada, relocating the plant to Nevada. Another company is a service company. They're looking at Scottsdale, Arizona. I have another company or individuals that are talking about leaving California if we raise our tax rates up to 12.3%. I have got several companies or individuals we're talking to now about converting their subchapter S corporations to C Corp. If the president is reelected, we're talking about tax replacement trust to handle an increase in estate taxes, the drop in exemption, charitable trust, and there are a number of tools that we're using, but you're absolutely right. Like I said, we're going to be probably working 6 day weeks, depending on the outcome in November, because you basically have got 2 months to put things into effect. Otherwise, you're going to get hammered and clobbered when it comes to January.
You know, I always like to bring it over to another topic, and that is because you have a lot of people who are just getting by. It's a questionable as to how much surplus they have or how much they can set aside. Well, what about the average guy that's there? Are they just left to the mercy of everything that's happening or what?
No. I mean, you take a look at the very first case that we talked about. Bill and Jan Smith were, you know, Jan, who was making $82,000 as a teacher, was going to retire, and her retirement, her pension, was only going to be a little over 60%. I think it was 66% of her salary. And we made up with that with an immediate annuity, in effect, creating their own private defined benefit pension plan. You know, I've worked with individuals. I worked on a case at the beginning of the year where the couple, we advised them, and this made a lot of sense anyway, to sell their house in California. Now, fortunate for this couple, he bought their house when they first moved to California back in the early 80s. So even though real estate prices have fallen, they still had the house was paid for, fortunately, and they had enough equity in their house that they could sell it and come out with money. And they moved to Arizona where their daughter was. So they moved closer, and then they were able to buy a house, pay cash for it. Houses are much cheaper in Arizona than they are in Southern California. They had some money, you know, that also created a cushion left over. So, I mean, you can do everything from setting up your own personal pension plan. You can sell the house, you can downsize and use the equity. We've been in situations where the individuals have been advised and are working part-time to supplement their income, or they've delayed the age of retirement and also delayed receiving Social Security, so they got full Social Security benefits, or we changed their investment strategy. So there's a lot of tools, John. You don't have to be worth mega bucks to work with, but the most important thing is come up with a plan. Develop a budget, deal with the fears or the things and concerns that you have, and then you formulate a plan that allows you to retire securely, and then that, once again, you monitor it so it allows you to react to changes in the economy, changes in the markets, or personal changes due to health or financial circumstances. Maybe you have kids that have lost their job, you know, children that have gotten divorced. You know, in 30 years of planning, I've pretty much seen it all, but there's pretty much, you know, unless you fail and done everything wrong, you know, you can usually plan your way out of it. And I've got a case study. We weren't able to do a plan because this was a couple that did just about everything that you can think of wrong. We're going to call this couple the Mr. and Mrs. Disaster, and we'll be sharing that case with you. But their plan consisted of shooting from the hip, eat, drink, and be merry because hopefully things work out. Not exactly the best way to plan for your retirement, and it did not work out well. We'll talk more about that in the future.
You're listening to the Financial Sense NewsHour at financialsense.com.
Joining me on the program is FSN foreign correspondent Eric Townsend, who joins us from Paris. And Eric, last time you were on the show, you gave us a perspective of what you saw in Spain. You're in France now, and of course, they've got a new president who said he's against austerity. He wants to promote growth. I'm not sure how raising taxes to 75% is going to do that. But give me a perspective, if you will. How is Hollande perceived by the French people? In other words, obviously he won, so they didn't like the other guy's policies. Give me some insight in terms of what you're picking up from the people you talk to.
Well, just as you said, Jim, I was expecting there to be some public debate about the topic you just brought up, which is how is 75% tax on the people who are creating the jobs going to help? I don't think that the average man on the street is really engaged in that conversation. What I'm getting from most people that we've talked to is generally a sentiment that they believe in or they support the promises that Hollande made during his campaign, and they're waiting with some skepticism to see whether or not he's going to keep those promises and truly punish the rich with the 75% tax as he had said he would, or if he's going to be just another crony who doesn't deliver for the common man. The part about the common man's interests not being well served by these socialist policies is something that I thought there would be more discussion of, and I really haven't encountered very much of it at all with people that I've spoken with. I went and looked for more conservative publications. I looked particularly at a magazine called L'Express, L'Express in English. And, of course, the magazine is written in French, but on the cover, they've got a picture of Hollande and, they call him the hypnotist. And it says he, espouses, pushing back of the reforms and it lulls the French into sleep. But is he really doing anything to solve France's actual financial challenges?
Eric, let me stop you there and talk about these reforms. What exactly were these reforms? Were they to cut back on the size of government, reduce the deficit? Can you explain that?
Well, they were talking about the austerity that was put into place by President Sarkozy, his predecessor. And what Hollande has done is to reverse some of those changes, removing the austerity measures. And that is popular with the people. They're waiting to see how much follow through there will be on all of the promises that he made. The other side of the argument, which I was able to find in the more conservative center-right press, is saying, well, you know, he's pushing out these austerity reforms in order to lull the French into a state of contentment, but he doesn't appear to be doing anything, at least in this one publication's perspective, that would otherwise assuage the problems that the country faces. So if you're not going to solve the problem by austerity, how are you going to solve it? And it doesn't appear that anybody is really terribly satisfied that they're seeing any action yet. When I began doing this, it was kind of a challenge. I was actually taking French publications like this magazine, L'Express, and typing in some of the headlines and the articles into Google Translate to translate it into English. Then I found this fantastic website that I want to tell our listeners about. If anybody's interested in learning more about the European perspective on this crisis, there's a website called www.english.rfi.fr. RFI stands for Radio France International. And what they do is they put together an executive summary of all of the French press. So think about this as being, you know, Wall Street Journal, Business Week, People Magazine, etc. But the French versions of those, and they also do it for some other European countries. And then they translate it into English. So it's a website where you can get an English translation summary of what was in the European press in the past week. And I found it, in terms of researching what we're doing here, to be a fantastic website. They quote L'Express as describing, you know, so we've got this guy Hollande. He's talking about how he's going to reform, get rid of these austerity measures for the benefit of the common man. Meanwhile, he now has access, he and his administration, to executive jets, government cars, official residences, bodyguards, and so on and so forth. The conservative publication found out that while President Hollande and Prime Minister Jean-Marc I can't pronounce these French names, Jim. The Prime Minister decreed a crackdown on lavish spending, and now they have their jets and their cars and their official residences to celebrate their success in. So it's a skeptical view that's being expressed, but nobody seems to really feel like anybody has the solution to France's economic problems in sight. There's criticism as to what he's not done or what he's about to do, but nobody really sees what the solution is going to be.
You know, this is interesting because you mentioned the crackdown on lavish spending. We had the same thing with the Obama administration here. We had the Speaker of the House at that time, Nancy Pelosi, flying on a 737 private jet, $2 million in meals. So what you're telling me, why they talk about this in the public when they get into power, they love all the, let's say, perks that come with power, whether it's private jets, bodyguards, palaces, lavish vacations. I mean, you know, you want to go visit someplace, well, you have a summit. So is there any backlash against that, or is that pretty much buried in the press?
Well, it's in the press, but this is, I had to go out of my way to look for a center-right publication because there's really a lot of left-leaning publications, and they're on the other side of this, which is, well, they want to see more. They say, okay, this guy promised he's going to punish the rich. Let's see him punish the rich. We're waiting. Come on, bring it on. The side of the argument, the side of the public discussion that I was expecting to see, perhaps naively, was that at least some people would be saying, wait a minute, these things are not going to help the country. We need to go the other way and start looking at reforming some of our policies that cause us to spend beyond our means on social programs that we can't afford. I don't see anybody saying that. The discussion among most people is, will he or won't he keep all of his campaign promises?
Now, here's the interesting thing, and I'd like to get your perspective on this, because one of the pieces of legislation that he passed was a $7.6 billion increase on the wealthy. He hasn't put forth his 75% tax rate, but we know from stories, Eric, in Bloomberg, the Wall Street Journal, and the Financial Times, that prior to Hollande's, let's say, election, there were a number of wealthy individuals that had already exited France. There were big real estate sales taking place in Switzerland and Belgium. And then also Prime Minister Cameron in England gave a speech and said, you know what, we welcome France's wealthy. We're going to roll out the red carpet. And what you're telling me is nobody's saying, okay, let's get the rich. And if we do that, we're going to have more goodies, because he's promised to create 60,000 new government jobs, make benefits for government employees, increase those benefits. But nobody is asking, I guess, how are these things are going to be paid for? Do they simply feel, is the general feeling that, well, we'll just raise, and if we can make the rich pay more, we can have all these benefits and there will be no adverse economic consequences?
Well, actually, that has been covered in this week's press. I found that on that same website, the RFI website. There have been reports of a mass exodus of wealthy French from the country, moving to Switzerland and Great Britain and other places. But some of the publications are now refuting that and saying, no, it's all propaganda. It's not really true. The French are staying in France. And they've actually gone to the length of looking for some visible people, celebrities and so forth. I don't have the names in front of me. There was one guy who was a comedian, another guy who was an actor or something, who've gone on record saying, you know, we're wealthy French, we're staying in France. I'm not sure what that proves, but it seems that at least one side of the argument is trying to make a case that these reports of wealthy French leaving the country are not justified. And I don't know that I agree with that myself, but that's the perspective that I found in the press here.
It reminds me, Eric, of Margaret Thatcher's statement, the problem with socialism is you eventually run out of other people's money. You were able to talk to an individual, an economist, that believes very strongly in socialism. Tell them a little bit about this. This was a lead that you followed up from one of our listeners.
Yeah, it sure was. And, you know, I do come to this with my own perspective. I think that this is about socialism running out of other people's money to spend. I think that Europe has lived on borrowed money for decades and has, you know, the credit card has run out. And I feel that they really are out of money and going to have to reform some of these programs. But one of the most important lessons that I've learned from listening to you, Jim, over the years is that you never, as an investor, want to surround yourself with people that you agree with, because you just get a confirmation bias that closes your mind to other perspectives. So I was really delighted. I want to send out my special thanks to Doug in Sweden, who was good enough to email us in response to our request with the suggestion of interviewing Franck Biancari, who is the founder of a think tank in France called LEAP E2020. And he's a really smart guy. And to me, it's fascinating to meet a person that I disagree with on a lot of ideological issues, but who really is an intelligent, articulate, well-spoken individual. It is always fascinating for me. So this is a guy who called the financial crisis. He started writing in 2006, saying that he was anticipating a global economic crisis of epic proportions. Then in February 2008, he put a stake in the ground and said, I think it's going to be September, October of 2008 that it really hits the fan, so to speak. So this is a really smart guy who's got a lot going for him. But of course, he has a view that's very different from mine and I think yours with respect to socialism. He made an interesting point, though, distinguishing socialism from social benefits. If we could play the first clip from that interview.
We should not confuse the word social and socialism. Socialism is an ideology, which is supposing that the state has the right and is right in doing and organizing everything and so on and so on. And social issues is something different, social policies. It's trying to make the population, the fabric of a society, being more consistent, cohesive. So to avoid to have discrepancies, which are breaking apart society itself. And in that aspect, this is part of what makes Europe. It doesn't date from the 50s, the 60s, whatever. It has always been part of what Europe is made of, continental Europe. An attempt to keep its societies in such a consistent and cohesive situation that they don't break apart. In time of crisis, this is very important.
So the point that he's making there is he's distinguishing socialism as an ideology about the state being in charge of centrally planning everything from social benefits, which he claims are actually working to Europeans' benefit or to Europe's benefit in terms of its competitiveness. We didn't have time to play more than that short clip, but he goes on to explain why he thinks that the educational system in Europe is superior to the rest of the world and how these social benefits actually improve the competitiveness of Europe. Now, I have to give him credit, at least as a debate opponent, if you want to think of it that way, because he really hits me between the eyes when I asked him a question about socialism being unsustainable and the condition of socialism in the United States. He comes back at me with this next clip.
Which country has most of its economy depending on the government spending? I will say, for instance, which country has its car industry being in the end somehow somewhere of the government. Which country has one of its big components for the defense industry being completely depending on the government? Which country has its whole real estate and housing business depending solely on the capacity of its central bank and its government to make it survive and to avoid a complete collapse? Which country has about what third of its active population which is depending on the army directly or indirectly? Which country?
So I have to hand it to him. He makes a very good point that in many ways the United States is becoming more socialist even than Europe is. But frankly, I don't think that that is in any way a confirmation that socialism is a good idea. I think what it spells is that the United States is at risk of suffering the same fate that Europe is now facing if we don't change our ways and avoid this tendency towards socialism. But his point is that he feels that if anybody is a socialist country, it's more the United States than Europe, and he thinks that the social policies of providing education and so forth to all citizens on a more generous level than other countries do will actually benefit Europe substantially. And he lays out a three-part plan in the full interview where he basically says that over the next year he expects the ESM and the EFSF to be successful and effective in their intended purpose of stabilizing the sovereign debt crisis. He expects there to be an emergence of a state, a fiscal union, in addition to the monetary union that already exists. And then by 2015 to 2016, he expects a fully democratic state to emerge, where there's essentially a United States of what is presently the European Monetary Union. So those 17 countries would become a single nation that is bound by a democratic election system, which he believes would put Europe as top dog on the global stage as the most competitive nation in the global economy. And he thinks that the social policies that Europe has are going to be play a key role in getting Europe to that position of success and economic dominance. I don't quite agree with him, but I must say that of people that I've met who have an opposing view to my own with respect to socialism and socialist policies, this is a very smart, articulate man, and I would encourage our listeners, you know, if like myself, if you don't really believe in socialism, give this interview a listen, because I think that it is a chance to hear the other side of the argument from someone who is, in my opinion, more articulate and more intelligent than most of the socialists that I have encountered. We didn't have time to get it onto this weekend's show, but the full interview will be available at financialsense.com.
Eric, let's change gears here. There's another story that we're working on, which are the early signs of a U.S.-China Cold War. There were several articles in the Wall Street Journal this week talking about what's going on in the South China Sea with the islands, energy, and also about what China is doing with its military forces occupying islands. It's going to be a rather lengthy topic, so we don't have a lot of time to get into it in this segment in this week's show, but tell us a little bit of what you're seeing going on with, let's say, visa applications from U.S. citizens.
Well, that was one of the most interesting things to come across my desk this week, Jim, was my contacts in Hong Kong are telling me that suddenly there's a rash of rumors about American citizens being denied visa applications from the Chinese consulate. And my data is about Hong Kong. I don't know if it might be going on anyplace else. The data is still a little bit sketchy, but it appears that the pattern here is that they're imposing some kind of beneficial need test. In other words, if you've got a legitimate business contract to negotiate or some other reason to go to China that might benefit China by you going there, no problem. You can have a visa. But the people, for instance, who are living in China, teaching English, say, in order to make a living because they want to live there or whatever, are suddenly being kicked out and not having their visas renewed. In at least one case that I'm aware of, there was a person who actually had an apartment and lived in China who went to renew their visa and was not allowed back in, not even long enough to go back and collect their belongings. So I only know about a half a dozen cases here, but it seems to be a sudden thing, and as far as I can tell, it only seems to involve American citizens. It doesn't appear to be being applied to others, because I talked to a couple of Australians who just renewed visas and had no trouble. So we really could use some listener feedback on this. If you're listening to this program, if you or anyone you know has been denied a visa to China, particularly if you've had one before and you were trying to renew a visa, please email me at eric.townsend@financialsense.com. Let me know what your experience was and also particularly whether you are a U.S. citizen or a citizen of some other country. Now, all of this fits in very much in my mind to a thesis that I have, which is that we are right now in the earliest stages of a formative Cold War between the United States and China, which I believe will develop substantially over the next couple of decades. We are, as Jim said, working on putting a full show together about that subject, which we hope to air next week. But in the meantime, if anybody has any more information, it would be very helpful for us to know whether other people are being denied renewals of visas to enter China.
Eric, why don't you give out your email so if our listeners around the globe would like to contact you with either stories or information, they could do so, please.
Sure. It's eric.townsend, that's E-R-I-K dot T-O-W-N-S-E-N-D, at financialsense.com. And in addition to the visa issue, we're still looking, hoping to put together some kind of a roundtable discussion among Germans about this pro versus anti-ESF issue that the German Constitutional Court will be deciding on September 12th. So if we have any guest suggestions or contacts for that, I would appreciate that feedback as well.
Well, listen, Eric, I want to thank you for joining us on the Financial Sense NewsHour. Once again, we've been speaking with Eric Townsend, FSN foreign correspondent. And if you'd like to reach Eric, you could do so at eric.townsend@financialsense.com. Eric, thanks for joining us on the program. Have yourself a great weekend.
Always my pleasure, Jim.
Well, it was an interesting week. John Williams was one of the guests we had during the premium shows in the middle of the week. Also, Jeff Christian, Doug Nolan, and Owen Tracy, who are going to be the guests we're going to have coming up in the week to follow here.
On Monday, Eric Townsend has a next-level interview with a prominent economist, a French socialist. It's one of the things we always try to do on this program is get the opposing point of view, so that will be on Monday. Ned Schmidt will be a special guest on Tuesday, and he said there is a dichotomy between the drought in the U.S. and what's happening in our grain markets, and as well as what's happening overseas. There isn't a shortage of corn, believe it or not, in China, as well as Ned has a couple hot stocks, or really some great agricultural stocks with pricing power that we talk about that are worthwhile. William Black, the gentleman that did a lot of prosecution during the SNL crisis, he'll be on the program on Wednesday. Professor Oliver Inderwildy from Oxford University will be my guest on Thursday. Remember, we had him a couple of years ago. He talked about peak oil. He's got a new study that just came out from Oxford. He'll be here to discuss that on Thursday. Marin Katusha will be here on Friday to talk about this major natural gas find off the coast of Israel that can shift the entire geopolitics of the Middle East. So all that, John, coming up on Friday. But it is Friday. On behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense NewsHour. Until you and I speak again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
And I still want to eat your retirement funds.
Subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense NewsHour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the NewsHour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.